The Irish Times Inside Business Podcast, in association with EY, building a better working world.
Hello, this is Ciarán Hancock. Welcome to Inside Business. This week, I'll be talking about the housing crisis, but looking at it from a slightly quirky angle. Imagine if Michael O'Leary decided to set up a development company to build housing and applied some of the lessons from Ryanair's experience in disrupting the air travel business over the past three decades. It's a point that Irish Times economics correspondent Owen Burke Kennedy posited in a column earlier this week. You'll hear from him shortly, explaining his rationale. Paul Mitchell is a director of construction consultancy Mitchell McDermott, and he's an expert on construction costs. You'll hear from him later on about how it can cost almost €600,000 to build a two-bedroom urban apartment in Dublin. And he'll give his view on potential solutions that could drive down house building costs here. First, to Owen's idea around a Ryanair-style solution to house building. I began by asking him how it might work.
I supposed my basic supposition was that, you know, if you'd gone to Aer Lingus back in the 1980s and asked them why it was so expensive to fly from Dublin to London, a relatively short one-hour flight, they would have given you a route and branch explanation of the costs involved. They would have listed the cost inputs, and you might have gone away cowed into the belief that, look, air travel was just very expensive. And that was until the EU liberated the continent's aviation market and Ryanair came along and proved that the same product could be delivered for a fraction of the cost. So I wasn't suggesting that there was an obvious Ryanair model for construction. It was just that we seemed unable to provide cheap airfares back in the 80s. Now we can. So the question is, are we living in some sort of pre-Ryanair 1980s phase of housing with the cost of construction seemingly high and irrefutably so, and for reasons that no one can quite explain or see a way around? And are we going to get one of these days a company that can build for cheaper? And I suppose my column was based on the back of this report by consultancy Mitchell McDermott on behalf of the Department of Housing, which provided, yet again, we've had a few of these, a line-by-line account of the costs involved in delivering four building types in the greater Dublin area: a three-bed semi-detached house, a two-bed suburban apartment, a two-bed urban apartment, and a purpose-built student accommodation unit. Now, the eye-catching number was the $592,000 cost for a two-bed urban apartment. Obviously, as everyone knows, apartments are something that Ireland's low-density, undersupplied housing market has been crying out for. You know, we have a disproportionately low stock of apartments compared to our European counterparts. But at these costs, it's very difficult to see how we can kind of square the circle. So, you know, most people can observe that most of the apartments being built in Dublin are being funded by foreign funds and are predominantly for the affluent city centre rental markets. And that often alienates, you know, prospective buyers, especially families. Anyway, the Mitchell McDermott report gives you a kind of line-by-line account of the costs involved in building an apartment in the city centre.
Yeah.
It's very granular.
Yeah, sure. I just wanted to talk to you more about this idea of a Ryanair-style change to the housing market and a Ryanair-style operator coming along to build cheaper housing. I suppose what Ryanair did was it took away a lot of the frills, shall we say, of aviation travel, like, you know, your checked-in bag, for example, your guaranteed seat, the meal on the plane, all of that kind of stuff. And it said, if you want those, you can pay extra for them. But otherwise, we're going to offer you a really low fare by stripping away all of those elements and only allowing you to bring a certain amount of luggage and so on and so forth. So are we talking here, if some operator was to come into the market and do that kind of thing, that we might have a situation where, you know, they'd be building houses with no central heating or no doors or no gardens?
Well, that would be not a cheery thought given the Irish winter, but I talked to Brian Moran recently, who's the senior managing director at Hines Ireland, and he gave me an interesting account. He said, like, obviously the market, the construction industry now is heavily regulated for obvious reasons. We're looking at all the defects apartments from the Celtic Tiger era. But he said, you know, the cost of building modern homes because of the regulations was substantially higher in the south of Ireland, in the Republic, than it was in the north. So we had, you know, better standards, better build qualities than they specify in the north. And we have VAT, which isn't charged on construction in the north. So he said to me that something in terms of apartment that costs €496,000 in Dublin was costing around 300,000 in Belfast. So in many ways, we are, you know, he said he wasn't against these higher standards and higher building regulations, but they weren't exactly prioritising cost. And that was a problem for the industry. And then the other thing that Ryanair did bring to the equation was scale. Now, there's been a number of reports recently that talk about the lack of scale in home building in Ireland. There's only a few big companies that are building, and predominantly the industry comprises of small builders that are building, you know, a handful of units each year. And that is something that definitely would presumably cut the cost of building. But I make the point in my column that when you look at the costs involved in development here, there's no smoking gun. There's no like standout figure. A lot of critics will point to the land value, which seems to be amplified by prices. The cost of finance is definitely elevated. And we know for a fact that the domestic banking sector just isn't lending to construction firms in the way it was pre-crash. So there is areas that we can kind of fine-tune, tinker. But are we going to get back to, you know, that kind of Sinn Féin number of building homes for 300,000 a year? I'm sort of thinking, you know, there, somebody's going to have to come along and show us how that is done rather than, you know, someone like me or someone outside of the market telling, you know, construction industry practitioners and professionals who know the market better than anyone else how to do it.
Now, Paul Mitchell is a director with construction consultancy firm Mitchell McDermott. And Mitchell McDermott produced a report recently on behalf of the Department of Housing, which goes line by line through the costs of delivering housing types in the greater Dublin area. And Owen mentioned it. There was one eye-popping number, if you like, Paul, €592,000 for a two-bed urban apartment. I mean, it seems unreal. It seems, how could this be?
Yes, we did a detailed study for the department, which was a follow-on study to last year. So we actually took those same four unit types and compared them to five other cities in Europe.
How many developments were you looking at in producing this, you know, this piece of data?
Yeah, so what we did was actually took one development.
You took one development?
Yeah.
Okay.
So in the past, we've done the same study for the department, and the Society of Chartered Surveyors have done it, where we've taken in thousands of units, over 10,000 units in the last report. So, and it gives you a cost range. What the department wanted to figure out this time was, let's drill right down into the detail. So behind this layer of pricing, you say it's line by line, but underneath this, there's 6,000 lines of pricing.
Okay.
And we actually took that, and we had our travelling box, so-called, and we priced that in the other four cities in Europe to find out, to answer the question, is Ireland an expensive place to build?
How did you decide which developments to choose?
We were asked to choose a typical development for suburban apartment, an urban apartment, and what we chose was one with live costs. So one that was viable, that was getting built or was just built. So we did that for student, we did it for housing, and we did it for urban and suburban apartments.
Right.
So a real scheme. And then we took that real scheme, because what often happens in these reports is people use generalities and benchmarks and so on. What the department said, no. Give me an actual scheme. The scheme is not divulged to the department or anybody else, but give us that actual scheme and get other people to price that scheme and tell us why it's different. So what we found was that when the other countries that generally build for less than us priced that same scheme, it was plus or minus 5%, which was a surprise to us. So then we said, well, hang on.
A surprise in what way?
A surprise, because I thought they would be pricing it much lower.
Right.
So when they priced it, but then an interesting finding came out that said, why do you have 16 different window types in your apartment scheme? He said, because there's 16 different window types. And I said, well, we've only got four. We could put it this way, this way, or this way, but only four come out of the factory. So, and that kind of repeated itself in lots of things. Mm. Standardization was a huge thing. So basically, when you compared the five, they were there or thereabouts.
Yeah.
But then when you went back to the same cities and said, well, tell us what you build your product for, it was 17 to 34% less. And that was scope. And it goes back to something that Owen said at the beginning. So basically we have higher standards. We have higher building regulations. That's a fact. We have higher health and safety regulations. We have higher energy requirements. And we also have something, and I don't know whether this comes from the past when we first started building apartments and everyone said we've got shoebox apartments. There was a kind of lurch over here to kind of go, well, actually, we're not going to have those. We are going to have the best apartments. And the pendulum swung this way. And when you go to get planning for a scheme now, you have to comply with a lot of different things. And you have to impress the planners to say the scheme is high quality. And we won't get into planning just yet. But on a recent scheme that we were managing for a local authority, we had over 35 separate consultants employed just to submit the planning application.
35?
35 consultants. Go back 10 years, we probably had six. But we have to have people for wind, we have to have people for shadow analysis, we have to have people for all sorts of environmental issues. Like, it's got, we have really overcomplicated this. And I, it was interesting, you know, reading Owen's article and saying the Ryanair model, and it did kind of go, oh, well, let's think about that for a second. What would Michael O'Leary do if he got into the housing market?
Well, yeah, sure. But it's interesting that you mentioned in the other cities, they have four types of windows, let's say, against 16 here. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you could maybe apply a Ryanair model to, because they just take a certain type of Boeing aircraft. There are no pockets in front of the seats, as we all know. They're all leather seats. They're designed a specific way. It's just, it's safe, obviously, but it's in terms of the consumer-facing element, it's stripped right back.
Correct.
And it's the same on every aircraft. So the aircraft maintenance costs presumably are minimized and so forth. So if you introduce that standardization in windows and maybe other elements as well, then you probably could trim some costs.
You could, and I think the potential trip, I'm not saying it's there, but the potential trip then is that you go in for planning and they go, that scheme looks a bit ordinary and it looks a bit regular and it doesn't really add to the urban fabric and it looks exactly like the one previous, so we're not giving you planning. That's common. That's a common. And then developer A is competing with developer B to let those units or sell those units. So they're saying, well, I need to build it better than the other one. That's common. The other thing that we do is we build houses bigger than elsewhere, right?
Houses or apartments?
Houses and apartments, right? So both, we build them bigger in each case. And in the study, we actually took a housing unit, but then found out it was 120 square metres when we can build it for 98 square metres. Now, do people want to have a house that doesn't have a downstairs toilet or an ensuite? No. And the other thing we found in other European cities was that they don't fit these out. They don't, in some cases, they will leave floor finishes, there won't be ceiling finishes, you will see the bare concrete above your head, you might see a bare concrete wall. In some cases, they don't even put in the kitchen. It's called grey box living. So you get your apartment for something that you can afford, and go back to affordability, and you might move into that apartment as a single person. A one-bed apartment, and you might put in a couple of IKEA units. You then might come along later and let's say you move in with somebody into that one-bed apartment, or and then you move on and have a child. So the kind of apartment then builds and gets fitted out as your circumstances change.
Or you just leave and go to a bigger apartment.
Or just leave and go to another house. Box. Yeah. You know? But like we have been tracking apartments since, you know, the early 2000s, right? And we've seen the rise and fall of apartments and all the rest. And one of the things that made a big change here was when we had the build-to-rent guidelines, which are now no longer. In effect, we have apartment designs, which are very specific, which you have to follow. And we have known for a long time, we did our first report on apartment viability in 2016 for the Society of Chartered Surveyors. And we knew then it didn't work. And we grappled with that all through the kind of coming out of the crash. But the one big change was when international funds got involved and they funded the entire thing for rent. Okay, now I know we don't want all apartments to be rent, but I can tell you there's a lot of people out there that do. And a lot of people making decisions might be people my age who don't want to live in an apartment. And are making decisions for people that are very happy to live in an apartment. But in that case, the numbers switched. 51. So not to be published. But in that case, when the funds got involved, the numbers skyrocketed, right? We had planning permissions coming through. So in 2017, our numbers changed, right? So if we go back to there and say, could you do that again? The numbers changed, the funds came into the market, and there was more product coming to rent. What happened? Build-to-rent was stopped as a product. You know, people were against funds in general, even though these are teacher pension funds from the US or wherever they are. And then there was this push to say, okay, now the funds have got a hold of the market. Let's stop them. Let's push them away. They are not here at the moment in the numbers that they were.
Well, they are here. I mean, they own a lot of apartments. IRES is still the biggest landlord, private landlord in the country.
Yeah.
I appreciate that they're not investing in the way they were, but, you know, there are probably external factors like interest rates and so forth.
Correct.
Shareholders aren't particularly happy with the returns they're getting from IRES and all of that kind of stuff. But it's become a political football, that whole element. No question about that. But just to say, on the apartments side of it, I seem to recall that Owen Murphy, as housing minister, he increased the heights that were allowed for apartments, for example.
Yeah.
And the specs were definitely lowered.
It depends on what you mean by specs, right? The specification, the only thing that was talked about at the time was the size, right? And people said we have shoebox apartments. They still say we have shoebox apartments, even though the sizes are above other European counterparts, right? So the spec, all that was done at the time was there was a set of guidelines put out there. And in 2007, they said, here are the guidelines.
Yep.
And these are a minimum. And then all the local authorities in 2008 said, we're going to do better. And they started trying to say, you have to build yours 20%, 30% bigger. And nothing got built. And then we had the crash. They came back. And in 2016, they said, no, that's it. Stop with all your individual targets. You must follow these.
Mm.
So that's what came out. They weren't new.
Mm.
Right.
Where are we at in terms of car parking spaces now? It used to be the case that in Dublin, anyway, they wanted one space per apartment.
Mm.
Am I right? That was changed, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was changed. And basically then it left it up to the local authority to say, let's reduce car parking because it was such a big cost, particularly for apartments. On a recent study of 22 separate developments, the average was 0.7 spaces per unit.
Right.
So not fully one for one.
Okay. So it has come down.
Oh, yeah.
So that's saving money.
And that's really helped.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because the car parking costs, if we look at your €592,000 two-bed urban apartment, the car parking costs...
34.
Just over €34,000.
Yeah.
So it's substantial.
It is. And
now, I suppose what could happen in that situation, because a lot of people might say, well, hold on, how can you live without a car? You know, because I mean... You know, people need to get around and you could have kids who need to be dropped here and there. You might want to go home if you're from the country. You might want to go home and visit your family and all of that. So you need a car. They could be charged extra for that. You could strip that out of the, you're still going to build it. The cost is still there, but you could charge that separately to somebody over and above the apartment, couldn't you?
You could. And
wasn't that happening in the Celtic Tiger years?
I think they'd gone above one and they were trying to build an extra car park space and sell that one. And people could afford to buy it and they could get a mortgage for it. If you have to build it in the first place, it's a huge cost. It's a sunk cost. And then you are living on hope factor then that you can rent it and you're putting it out over time, right? And the better thing to do is build half the amount of spaces, right? Get it down to 0.5 and then have 10% of your spaces for rent cars, you know, and have all of the companies there that when they want to go home or go to the shops, you see a lot of them around the city now. On your phone, rent your car, particularly urban, you know, because basement schemes in city centres are extremely expensive. So that 34 grand, if that was one for one in a city centre site with contamination and all the rest, could be over €100,000. So it was a big move. And at the time, and it came after the society's report, and it was a big move and it did reduce costs without damaging the value of the asset to the
How can harnessing the power of AI help drive your business? At EY, we combine leading business expertise with cutting-edge technology and capabilities. Working directly with you to plan your strategy, we will accelerate your AI-enabled transformation. To learn more, visit ey.ai/IE.
Individual.
Let's go back to Owen's point of view. Michael O'Leary looking at the housing market and saying, how could I disrupt the housing market? What would be his chances in your view?
I'd say there'd be the same chances of Michael O'Leary getting the passenger cap moved in Dublin Airport. Because Michael O'Leary was in charge of what he was doing when he went off to negotiate with airports that were slightly outside city centres and all the rest, right? And if you're here, and that the issue with housing in general is that it's fragmented. Different people are in charge of different necessary parts at different times. And if those people aren't doing their job, like zoning land, like putting infrastructure in place, like putting LAPs in place, then, and the developer comes along and then can't move it on to the next stage.
So LAPs are local area plans.
So, you know, priority area plans or urban development zones, as they're now called, right? But we presented this recently and I called it from need to keys. The steps to kind of establishing the need, right, which we have fallen down on over the last few years. And we've just got the national planning framework just about to come out, which says this is where areas should be developed. But at the moment, we have developers that can't develop sites, even though they're serviced, because they're not zoned. Okay, so hopefully that gets changed. So you have to zone the land, right? So that's in the that's at the behest of the local authority.
And local authorities, I suppose, would argue that they only want so much land zoned and being developed at any one time, and that's, you know, they feel that that's enough to meet the population demands within their local authority area.
Yeah, but that's been the issue because the MPF to date is based on the 2016 census.
Yeah.
And it didn't, and we grew a lot quicker.
Yeah.
So it didn't meet the needs.
So we've had a census since then, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the population continues to grow.
Exactly, yeah. So we were a long period of time using lower numbers than we should have been using. So therefore, the land got de-zoned, and now we're left in this position. But the other key piece to this is the servicing. This is Irish Water, ESB, TII, that we've got, and we've got a deficit of infrastructure across the island. We know that. But what we have to do with our limited resources is get all of those bodies to focus in on the one area. Get a council to say, how do I produce X percent of new units in the next 5 years?
Mm.
Identify lands. Say, well, I've got water over here and I've got power over in this side of the town, right, or city. Well, let's focus all the infrastructure players in one place to get the best bang for a buck. Then activate that area. Then all together in unison move to the next site or area to be developed and spend our money there.
Yeah, that sounds very logical, but what are the chances of it happening, you know, given...
I sat on one of the working groups in the Housing Commission for a year and a half, right? There is a very detailed paper there, and lots of people put in significant amounts of time into it, which I haven't seen much by way of examination of it or take up of that report yet. But in that report, one of the things that we said, look, let's get a central body, not to create another Quango or whatever else, but let's get someone at the top that has the power to pull in the infrastructure companies, to pull in the planners, to say in each county, this is what we need to do. But to demand it as opposed to say, would you mind coming over here when you're not too busy, please?
Mm.
Right? That's what's needed. We need...
Sounds like another Quango now, if you don't mind me saying.
It does. But here's a Quango, right? We've got the Land Development Agency,
yeah.
Right? That, in my own personal opinion, has... You know, it takes a long time to get these things set up and get the flywheel turning, but it is turning, right? And there's lots of really good things happening that people on the street don't see or only starting to see.
To be fair to the LDA now, they have to respect the planning process and so on.
They have to
go through the hoops like every private developer.
Exactly.
And
yep.
Takes time.
More so, because they have to be absolutely squeaky clean in everything that they do. Like everyone else, there are no shortcuts. But if you take that body... Right, that has all that expertise in-house, which is a public body, and you say to that public body, you go and help each of the councils put together their plan. you be the central repository for that information and put these plans and servicing into place to get things moving along, because it is stuck there at the moment. It's stuck there, and we know it's stuck in planning, and those issues are being hopefully dealt with the new act and so on. But I see housing from that need to keys as a pipeline, and it's stuck up at the front. We've got some knots and bulges up front. If we free those up, we zone all the land we need, we get local area plans done for all of the sites, and we move it and we service all the sites, and we move it on further down the hose. We've got another kink waiting us there, which is resources in the industry, right? Numbers, contractors, labour.
Apparently we need an extra 80,000 workers for housing.
Yeah, or 20,000 if we're really productive. I haven't looked at the numbers behind it. I just saw the article today. We do need labour. We do need more contractors. And to be honest, the whole housing pipeline, we need more of everything.
Yeah.
We need more funding. We need more land zoned, et cetera, et cetera.
So if we did all that, Paul, and we got the extra workers, would the price of housing come down?
The price of housing should come down because we'll have more competition. It's exactly what Mr. O'Leary did. Right, rent will come down. Right, so and then
what are the prospects of all of that happening now? In your view, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being it's absolutely going to happen, all of it's going to happen, and prices are going to come down. What are the chances? Do you think
in what time scale? Because that's
choose your time scale, doesn't it?
Yeah,
10 years.
I'd say if it was a concerted effort put in, everybody switched on their green lights today, it would take us about 5 to 7 years to get to that place.
And by how much do you think prices might come down?
Impossible to tell. I'd say you could see construction costs come down by 10%. You can see the players in the industry. You can see the scale players.
The hard construction costs in your report were 266,000 for that 2-bed urban apartment. So are you saying 10% off that? In other words, 26,000?
Plus the basement and site works. You know, you've got 300,000 there of hard costs. The only issue about saying it'll come down by 10% is that every year costs are going up. We have another set of fire regulations about to come in that are going to add more cost that nobody will have any choice over. So we will have to do sprinklers.
What's that going to add?
We don't know yet. So they're not actually put in place. But they could add another 5 to 10,000 euros per unit. It's kind of that type of order.
Yeah.
Right.
And is there a danger, Paul, that given that people are kind of conditioned now to pay these prices for apartments and houses around the country, that property developers will just say, yeah, sure, costs will come down, but I'll just pocket the difference?
They can, but that's where competition comes into play, right? We need...
Where's that competition going to come from?
From other developers.
From where? I mean, in Ireland or elsewhere? Do you think external developers from other countries are going to come
Ireland,
from somewhere?
Where's the next Cairn? Where's the next Glenveagh?
Exactly. Where is it?
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, that's... those typically, if you look at what's happened to those... So those are two public companies, right? Companies that were private companies that had a land bank that said, okay, let's refund this in a public... format, and off we go. There are other players in recent years that have already attempted that. So if there's a fund there and they can see Ireland and they can see that pathway where they think things are not going to change, that the political interference is not going to change the rules again, is not going to close down build to rent, is not going to close down co-living, is not going to put rental caps in place or change what happens to funds. All this indecision. So Michael O'Leary takes off in Dublin Airport and he sets off for Croatia. He knows that there's a runway there and he knows what length it is. And in this situation where the developer sets off, there mightn't be a runway at all, or they might have moved it to Bratislava by the time he's in midair. And that's to keep that analogy going. So, okay.
Listening to Paul Mitchell there, Owen, I would suggest there's no prospect of a solution to the housing crisis in view, and the chances of house prices coming down or apartment prices coming down in the next 5 years, 7 years, 10 years is probably very low.
It's a very bleak assessment, and even in his optimistic scenario where, you know, cost might come down by 10%, he almost within a sentence or two negated that with saying that the new fire regulations are going to increase the cost. The point I take away from his narrative, which is very cogent and very close to the ground, is just how fragmented the industry is, you know, at the supply level. And I do take the industry's kind of central viewpoint is that, you know, are we prioritizing affordability on the supply, you know, level? I mean, there's regulations, there's standards that maybe have a different motive incentive, and that is making it difficult to build affordable homes. We've backed ourselves into a corner on finance. The domestic banks don't lend to construction firms anymore, not to any great degree. We've had 3 years of inflation that's raised input costs across the industry. So we have that very complex, fragmented, price-intense supply side. And then the government's policy is to help buyers pay the higher price. So we have the government applying these, help to buy schemes. Which is kind of maintaining the price level at the high level. And that's a kind of short-term politically motivated solution to our housing crisis. But what are they doing on the planning level? They've got this new reform bill. Will it be the great big, you know, silver bullet that we all hope? It's not obvious that it will be, but it'll improve things. But we're kind of inching along without any big solution on the horizon.
Paul, is there any country in Europe that's got it right, has cracked this? And you can say, that's the model we should follow.
There are things, as part of that kind of European comparison, that was part of the thing we looked at in another recent report for the Department of Housing. We also looked at the same thing more for SME house builders. There are things that are working, right? Not to be completely bleak. And, you know, you might have heard, you know, a few years ago here, they were talking about the Vienna model, which is, if you look at what Dublin City Council and Fingal County Council are doing at the moment for their joint venture lands. So they're taking lands of which they own, so state lands, and they go out to a competition to developers and they say, bid me the best price and you develop these units. But you take the risk of developing those. Now, I might buy some of them at the end and I might have some as cost rental, and I might have some affordable purchase, and I will have some social, and you've got the rest as private.
Mm-hmm. They were expensive though, weren't they?
They are expensive. Like, this is the thing that, you know, apartments in urban settings are expensive, and especially then typically what's quoted is the cost of a three-bed because it's the biggest unit, not the cost of a studio. So all these reports are always done on two beds, just as a kind of an average and usually the majority. That model is working, right? And when we spoke to, as part of the Housing Commission, we spoke to the German Commission for the reduction of construction costs. So
they have a commission for the reduction of construction costs. Outstanding.
Yeah, outstanding. And I was very excited to talk to this economist, and I did for a number of hours. And he said, we worked for, I think it was 2.5 years. They came up with over 60 recommendations. They implemented 16 of them, and costs went up. And if you talk to any, and as part of the recent reports and research, we've spoken to a lot of people. They all have the same issue. Right? The UK can't meet the housing numbers. They talk about costs, viability and affordable issues. It's, and in the discussion with the German economist, I could have exchanged the word Germany for Ireland throughout the whole conversation. Mm-hmm. Right? So, but if you take something else that's working really well, that's come into play is cost rental. Owen mentioned affordability, right? So you've got viability. Can I sell something for more than it costs me? Is it viable? But can people afford it, right, is the key question. And for these apartments and for rental, we're up at the top, you know, third decile in terms of our country and what they can actually afford to pay. But the cost rental model, and the cost rental model means basically we only take the costs, right? We don't take any profit, and we don't typically take land because they're publicly backed, right? And so we just take the construction cost and we basically rentalize it over 40 years. It's like building your own house and your own land that you got for free and getting a mortgage for 40 years, and that is your rent, cost rent. That, in terms of affordability, in my mind, from what I've seen, is a game changer, right? For producing rental, more rental stock. and the local authorities and the LDA are pushing that big time. And then what they did was last year, in terms of the incentives that the government have brought out, is something called STAR, which is effectively cost rental for private developers, that they do it and they have to keep it in rental stock for 50 years. So there are things that are working. And like, there's a raft of government initiatives that have been put in place, like Croí Cónaithe, for to help this gap. So this report and the information in it is not new, and it's not a surprise to government bodies or people in the industry. You know, we've got the feedback to say, yeah, we actually agree with the numbers from developers or other players. So what do you do about it? Right. And for those things not to be overwritten by just changes in politics.
Okay. Owen, just to finish on this point, there's probably one element we haven't considered, and that's NIMBYism, not in my backyard. And in Britain, Keir Starmer came into government about 3 months ago, 4 months ago, and he said he was going to do away with NIMBYism and they were going to build everywhere in order to solve the housing issues over there. Do you think that would work in an Irish context?
Well, I mean, we hear these, you know, great, you know, optimistic sentiments, but do away with NIMBYism. I mean, where would you even start to prosecute that sort of ambition? You know, we saw how litigious the country is, you know, with all these high court reviews of various different building schemes. It's hard to see, you know, what that even means. It's aspirational. I mean, they have a movement in the US called YIMBYism now, which is young people saying yes in my backyard, and how dare you kind of middle-aged older people give out and, you know, object to everything when I can't buy a house at an affordable rate. So I don't know. Yeah, it's aspirational, but I think, you know, Paul's point is, I thought the German example was pretty interesting. We tend to think of, you know, the housing crisis as a purely very Irish phenomenon, or at least one that's very exaggerated here, but it seems to be creepingly ubiquitous, judging from what we can see abroad. And that point about the commission coming up with 60 recommendations, Germany implementing 16, and then house prices going up. I mean, that's a scenario that you could imagine has happened here a number of times.
Paul, can we deal with NIMBYism?
I think the major way that we deal with that is these local area plans. If you look at something that's worked really well, Dublin City South Docks. It was obviously back in the day contaminated, wasn't a no-go area for your city.
The gas.
Yeah, gas and
big stuff. Gas plants,
stuff coming out of it, right? And what did the state do? The state went in and they cleared all the contamination. They put it on boats and they sent it to Germany, actually, because they were probably cheaper back then. They cleared it all and they set up competitions for developers. And they said, we want you to build a hotel here, put your best bid in. We want you to put in apartments here, put your best bid in. We got the Borg Gosh, we got various things all around the South Docks. And over the course of what, you know, 15 years or so, it was transformed, right? The same thing is happening in Clonbarris at the moment. The same thing was planned for Cherrywood and it will get there. But in these cases, and on a different recent report, we said to the state are in control of the first few things at the front, right? Infrastructure and setting up those local area plans or priority area plans, whatever you want to call them. But they put the plan in place. They talk to everybody. They get the consensus from everybody in that area. What do you want? And then they say, okay, we've consulted with everyone. We've got a 3D plan in your local authority. Go down and touch and feel the model, see what it looks like. Now, the die is now cast. Nobody can come back in 2 years' time and submit a judicial review or club together and stop every single development that's going through. This is now the plan. And this is the plan that's going to be built out over 10 years. That's the future. And that's what the planning bill envisages. But those plans take a long time and we should be on those now. And I think that is, there's no short-term wins here. There are no silver bullets, as Owen said. There's 1,000 grey pellets. And that's one of the 1,000 grey pellets.
All right. Paul Mitchell and Owen Burke-Kennedy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ken.
Okay, that's it for this week from Inside Business. My thanks to Paul Mitchell and Owen Burke-Kennedy for joining me on the show. John Casey produced this episode with JJ Vernon on sound. Thanks also to our sponsor EY for its continued support. Remember, as a subscriber to the Irish Times, you can get the latest business news straight into your inbox by signing up to our Business Today email at irishtimes.com. And you can also follow the Irish Times business feed on X, LinkedIn and Facebook each day. I'm Ciarán Hancock. Until next time, take care.
The Irish Times Inside Business Podcast, in association with EY, building a better working world.